If the other balls in the wizard's rainbow did exist, most are broken now. Such things never stay in one place or one pair of hands for long, you know, and even enchanted glass has a way of breaking. Yet at least 3 or 4 bends of the rainbow may still be rolling around this sad world of ours. The blue, almost certainly. A desert tribe of slow mutants, the Total Hogs, they called themselves, had that one less than 50 years ago, although it's slipped from sight again since. The green and the orange are reputed to be in Lud and Dis, respectively, and just maybe the pink one. What exactly do they do? Roland asked. What are they good for? For seeing. Some colors of the wizard's rainbow are reputed to look into the future. Others look into the other worlds, those where the demons live, those where the old people are supposed to have gone when they left our world. These may also show the location of the secret doors which pass between the worlds. Other colors, they say, can look far in our own world and see things people would as soon keep secret. They never see the good, only the ill. How much of this is true and how much is myth, no one knows for sure. He looked at them, his smile fading. But this we do know. John Farson is said to have a talisman, something that glows in his tent late at night, sometimes before battles, sometimes before large movements of troop and horse, sometimes before momentous decisions are announced, and it glows pink. Maybe he has an electric light and puts a pink scarf over it when he prays, Cuthbert said. He looked around at his friends, a little defensively. I'm not joking. There are people who do that. Perhaps, Roland's father said. Perhaps that's all it is, or something like. But perhaps it's a good deal more. All I can say of my own knowledge is that he keeps beating us. He keeps slipping away from us, and he keeps turning up where he's least expected. If the magic is in him, and not in some talisman he owns, God's help the affiliation. We'll keep an eye out, if you like, Roland said, but Farson's in the north or west. We're going east, as if his father did not know this. If it's a bend of the rainbow, Stephen replied, it could be anywhere, east or south's as likely as west. He can't keep it with him all the time, you see. No matter how much it would ease his mind and heart to do so, no one can. Why not? Because they're alive and hungry, Stephen said. One begins using 'em, one ends being used by 'em. If Farson has a piece of the rainbow, he'll send it away and call it back only when he needs it. He understands the risk of losing it, but he also understands the risk of keeping it too long. There was a question which the other two, constrained by politeness, couldn't ask. Roland could and did. You are serious about this, Dad? It's not just a leg pull, is it? I'm sending you away at an age when many boys still don't sleep well if their mothers don't kiss them goodnight, Stephen said. I expect to see all 3 of you again, alive and well. Magus is a lovely, quiet place, or was when I was a boy. But I can't be sure of it. As things are these days, no one can be sure of anything. I wouldn't send you away with a joke and a laugh. I'm surprised you think it. Cry your pardon, Roland said. An uneasy peace had descended between him and his father, and he would not rupture it. Still, he was wild to be off. Rusher jigged beneath him, as if seconding that. I don't expect you boys to see Merlin's glass, but I didn't expect to be seeing you off at 14 with revolvers tucked in your bedrolls either. Ka's at work here, and where Ka works, anything is possible. Slowly, slowly, Stephen took off his hat, stepped back, and swept them a bow. Go in peace, boys, and return in health. Long days and pleasant nights, Si, Alan said. Good fortune, Cuthbert said. I love you, Roland said. Stephen nodded. Thank you, Si. I love you, too. My blessings, boys. He said this last in a loud voice, and the other 2 men, Robert Allgood and Christopher Johns, who had been known in the days of his savage youth as Burning Chris, added their own blessings. So the 3 of them rode toward their end of the great road, while Summer lay all about them, breathless as a gasp. Roland looked up and saw something that made him forget all about the wizard's rainbow. It was his mother, leaning out of her apartment's bedroom window, the oval of her face surrounded by the timeless gray stone of the castle's west wing. There were tears coursing down her cheeks, but she smiled and lifted one hand in a wide wave. Of the three of them, only Roland saw her. He didn't wave back. 8. Roland! An elbow struck him in the ribs, hard enough to dispel those memories, brilliant as they were, and return him to the present. It was Cuthbert. Do something, if you mean to. Get us out of this dead house before I shiver the skin right off my bones. Roland put his mouth close by Alain's ear. Be ready to help me. Alain nodded. Roland turned to Susan. After the first time we were together on Tet, you went to the stream in the grove.
Aye.
You cut some of your hair.
Aye.
That same dreaming voice.
So I did.
Would you have cut it all?
Aye. Every lick and lock.
Do you know who told you to cut it? A long pause. Roland was about to turn to Alain when she said,
Rhea.
Another pause.
She wanted to fiddle me up.
Yes, but what happened later? What happened while you stood in the doorway?
Oh, and something else happened before.
What?
I fetched her wood,
said she, and said no more. Roland looked at Cuthbert, who shrugged. Alain spread his hands. Roland thought of asking the latter boy to step forward and judged it still wasn't quite time. Never mind the wood for now, he said, or all that came before. We'll talk of that later, mayhap, but not just yet. What happened as you were leaving? What did she say to you about your hair?
Whispered in my ear. And she had a Jesus man.
Whispered what?
I don't know. That part is pink.
Here it was. He nodded to Alain. Alain bit his lip and stepped forward. He looked frightened, but as he took Susan's hands in his own and spoke to her, his voice was calm and soothing. Susan?
It's Alain Johns. Do you know me?
Aye. Richard Stockworth that was.
What did Rhea whisper in your ear? A frown, faint as a shadow on an overcast day, creased her brow.
I can't see. It's pink.
You don't need to see, Alain said. Seeing's not what we want right now. Close your eyes so you can't do it at all.
They are closed,
she said, a trifle pettishly. She's frightened, Roland thought. He felt an urge to tell Alain to stop, to wake her up, and restrained it.
The ones inside, Alain said.
The ones that look out from memory. Close those, Susan. Close them, for your father's sake, and tell me not what you see, but what you hear. Tell me what she said. Chillingly, unexpectedly, the eyes in her face opened as she closed those in her mind. She stared at Roland and through him with the eyes of an ancient statue. Roland bit back a scream.
You were in the doorway, Susan? Alain asked.
Aye. So we both were.
Be there again.
Aye.
A dreaming voice, faint but clear.
Even with my eyes closed, I can see the moon's light. 'Tis as big as a grapefruit.
It's the grapefruit, Roland thought, by which I mean it's the pink one.
And what do you hear? What does she say?
No, I say.
A faintly petulant voice of a little girl.
First I say, Alain. I say, and is our business done? And she says, mayhap there's one more little thing. And then...
Alain squeezed gently down on her hands, using whatever it was he had in his own, his touch, sending it into her. She tried feebly to pull back, but he wouldn't let her.
Then what?
What next?
She has a little silver medal.
Yes?
She leans close and asks if I hear her. I can smell her breath. It reeks of garlic. And other things, even worse.
Susan's face wrinkled in distaste.
I say I hear her. Now I can see. I see the metal she has.
Very well, Susan, Alain said. What else do you see?
Rhea. She looks like a skull in the moonlight. A skull with hair.
Gods, Cuthbert muttered and crossed his arms over his chest.
She says I should listen. I say I will listen. She says I should obey. I say I will obey. She says, aye, lovely, just so. It's a good girl you are. She's stroking my hair all the time, my braid.
Susan raised a dreaming, drowning hand, pale in the shadows of the crypt, to her blonde hair.
And then she says there's something I'm to do when my virginity's over.
Wait, she says, until he's asleep beside you. Then cut your hair off your head, every strand, right down to your very skull.
The boys looked at her in mounting horror as her voice became Rhea's, the growling, whining cadences of the old woman of the coos. Even the face, except for the coldly dreaming eyes, had become a hag's face.
Cut it all, girl, every horse strand of it, aye, and go back to him as bald as you came from your mother. See how he likes ye then.
She fell silent. Alain turned his pallid face to Roland. His lips were trembling, but he still held her hands. Why is the moon pink? Roland asked. Why is the moon pink when you try to remember?
It's her glam.
Susan seemed almost surprised, almost gay, confiding.
She keeps it under her bed, so she does. She doesn't know I saw it.
Are you sure?
Aye,
Susan said. Then added simply,
she would have killed me if she knew.
She giggled, shocking them all.
Rhea has the moon in a box under her bed.
She lilted this in the sing-song voice of a small child. A pink moon, Roland said.
Aye.
Under her bed.
Aye.
This time she did pull her hands free of Alain's. She made a circle with them in the air, and as she looked up at it, a dreadful expression of greed passed over her face like a cramp.
I should like to have it, Roland. So I should. Lovely moon. I saw it when she sent me for the wood, through her window. She looked young.
Then, once again,
I should like to have such a thing.
No, you wouldn't. But it's under her bed?
Aye, in a magic place she makes with passes.
She has a piece of Merlin's rainbow, Cuthbert said in a wondering voice. The old bitch has what your dad told us about. No wonder she knows all she does. Is there more we need? Alain asked. Her hands have gotten very cold. I don't like having her this deep. She's done well, but I think we're done. Shall I tell her to forget? Roland shook his head at once. They were quartet. For good or ill. He took hold of her fingers, and yes, they were cold. Susan?
Aye, dear?
I'm going to say a rhyme. When I finish, you'll remember everything, as you did before, all right? She smiled and closed her eyes again.
Bird and bear and hare and fish.
Smiling, Roland finished. Give my love her fondest wish. Her eyes opened. She smiled.
You,
she said again, and kissed him.
Still you, Roland. Still you, my love.
Unable to help himself, Roland put his arms around her. Cuthbert looked away. Alain looked down at his boots and cleared his throat. 9. As they rode back toward Seafront, Susan, with her arms around Roland's waist, she asked,
will you take the glass from her?
Best leave it where it is for now. It was left in her safekeeping by Jonas on behalf of Farson, I have no doubt. It's to be sent west with the rest of the plunder, I've no doubt of that either. We'll deal with it when we deal with the tankers and Farson's men.
You'd take it with us?
Take it or break it. I suppose I'd rather take it back to my father, but that has its own risks. We'll have to be careful. It's a powerful glam.
Suppose she sees our plans. Suppose she warns Jonas or Kimber Reimer.
If she doesn't see us coming to take away her precious toy, I don't think she'll mind our plans one way or the other. I think we've put a scare into her. And if the ball has really gotten a hold on her, watching it's what she'll mostly want to do with her time now.
And hold on to it, she'll want to do that, too.
Aye. Rusher was walking along a path through the Seacliff Woods. Through the thinning branches, they could glimpse the ivied gray wall surrounding Mayor's house and hear the rhythmic roar of waves breaking on the shingle below. You can get in safe, Susan?
No fear.
And you know what you and Shimi are to do?
Aye. I feel better than I have in ages. It's as if my mind is finally clear of some old shadow.
If so, it's Alain you have to thank. I couldn't have done it on my own.
There's magic in his hands.
Yes. They had reached the servants' door. Susan dismounted with fluid ease. He stepped down himself and stood beside her with an arm around her waist. She was looking up at the moon.
Look. It's fattened enough so you can see the beginning of the demon's face. Does thee see it?
A blade of nose, a bone of grin. No eye yet, but yes, he saw it.
It used to terrify me when I was little.
Susan was whispering now, mindful of the house behind the wall.
I'd pull the blind when the demon was full. I was afraid that if he could see me, he'd reach down and take me up to where he was and eat me.
Her lips were trembling.
Children are silly, aren't they?
Sometimes. He hadn't been afraid of Demon Moon himself as a small child. But he was afraid of this one. The future seemed so dark, and the way through to the light so slim. I love thee, Susan. With all my heart I do.
I know, and I love thee.
She kissed his mouth with gentle, open lips, put his hand on her breast for a moment, then kissed the warm palm. He held her, and she looked past him at the ripening moon.
A week until the reap, she said. Fin di año is what the vaqueros and labradoros call it. Do they call it so in your land?
Near enough, Roland said. It's called closing the year. Women go about giving preserves and kisses. She laughed softly against his shoulder.
Perhaps I'll not find things so different after all.
You must save all your best kisses for me.
I will.
Whatever comes, we'll be together, he said. But above them, Demon Moon grinned into the starry dark above the clean sea, as if he knew a different future. Chapter 6. Closing the Year. 1. So now comes to Magus Fin de Año, known in toward the center of Midworld as Closing the Year. It comes as it has 1,000 times before, or 10,000, or 100,000. No one can tell for sure. The world has moved on, and time has grown strange. In Magus, their saying is, time is a face on the water. In the fields, the last of the potatoes are being picked by men and women who wear gloves and their heaviest serapes, for now the wind has turned firmly, blowing east to west, blowing hard. And always there's the smell of salt in the chilly air, a smell like tears. Los Campesinos harvest the final rows cheerfully enough, talking of the things they'll do and the capers they'll cut at reaping fair. But they feel all of autumn's old sadness in the wind, the going of the year. It runs away from them like water in a stream, and although none speak of it, all know it very well. In the orchards, the last and highest of the apples are picked by laughing young men. In these not-quite gales, the final days of picking belong only to them, who bob up and down like crow's nest lookouts.
Above them, in skies which hold a brilliant, cloudless blue, squadrons of geese fly south, calling their rusty adieus. The small fishing boats are pulled from the water. Their hulls are scraped and painted by singing owners who mostly work stripped to the waist, in spite of the chill in the air. They sing the old songs as they work. I am a man of the bright blue sea, all I see, all I see. I am a man of the barren knee, all I see is mine, oh. I am a man of the bright blue bay, all I say, until my nets are full I stay, all I say is fine, oh. And sometimes a little cask of graff is tossed from dock to dock. On the bay itself, only the large boats now remain, pacing about the big circles which mark their drop nets as a working dog may pace around a flock of sheep. At noon, the bay is a rippling sheet of autumn fire, and the men on the boats sit cross-legged, eating their lunches, and know that all they see is theirs, oh, at least until the gray gales of autumn come swarming over the horizon, coughing out their gusts of sleet and snow. Closing, closing the year. Along the streets of Hambry, the reap lights now burn at night, and the hands of the stuffy guys are painted red. Reap charms hang everywhere, and although women often kiss and are kissed in the streets and in both marketplaces, often by men they do not know, sexual intercourse has come to an almost complete halt. It will resume with a bang, you might say, on reap night. There will be the usual crop of full-earth babies the following year as a result. On the drop, the horses gallop wildly, as if understanding, very likely they do, that their time of freedom is coming to an end. They swoop, and then stand with their faces pointing west when the wind gusts, showing their asses to winter. On the ranches, porch nets are taken down and shutters rehung. In the huge ranch kitchens and smaller farmhouse kitchens, no one is stealing reap kisses, and no one is even thinking about sex. This is the time of putting up and laying by, and the kitchens fume with steam and pulse with heat from before dawn until long after dark. There is the smell of apples and beets and beans and sharproot and curing strips of meat. Women work ceaselessly all day and then sleepwalk to bed, where they lie like corpses until the next dark morning calls them back to their kitchens. Leaves are burned in town yards, and as the week goes on and old demon's face shows ever more clearly, red-handed stuffy guys are thrown on the pyres more and more frequently. In the fields, corn shocks flare like torches, and often stuffies burn with them, their red hands and white cross eyes rippling in the heat. Men stand around these fires, not speaking, their faces solemn. No one will say what terrible old ways and unspeakable old gods are being propitiated by the burning of the stuffy guys, but they all know well enough. From time to time, one of these men will whisper two words under his breath. Charyu tree. They are closing, closing, closing the year. The streets rattle with firecrackers, and sometimes with a heftier big bang that makes even placid cart horses rear in their traces, and echo with the laughter of children. On the porch of the mercantile and across the street at the traveler's rest, kisses, sometimes humidly open and with much sweet lashing of tongues, are exchanged. But Coral Thorin's whores, cotton jillies, is what the airy fairy ones like Gert Moggins like to call themselves, are bored. They will have little custom this week. This is not year's end, when the winter logs will burn and magus will be barn dances from one end to the other. And yet it is. This is the real year's end, Charyu tree. And everyone, from Stanley Ruiz standing at the bar beneath the romp to the farthest of Fran Lengel's vaqueros out on the edge of the bad grass, knows it. There is a kind of echo in the bright air, a yearning for other places in the blood, a loneliness in the heart that sings like the wind. But this year there's something else as well. A sense of wrongness that no one can quite voice. Folks who never had a nightmare in their lives will awake screaming with them during the week of fin de año. Men who consider themselves peaceful will find themselves not only in fist fights, but instigating them,
Discontented boys who would only have dreamed of running away in other years will this year actually do it, and most will not come back after the first night spent sleeping raw. There is a sense, inarticulate but very much there, that things have gone amiss this season. It is the closing of the year. It is also the closing of the peace. For it is here, in the sleepy outworld barony of Magus, that Midworld's last great conflict will shortly begin. It is from here that the blood will begin to flow. In 2 years, no more, the world as it has been will be swept away. It starts here. From its field of roses, the Dark Tower cries out in its beast's voice. Time is a face on the water. Two. Coral Thorin was coming down the high street from the Bayview Hotel when she spied Shimi leading Capricoso and heading in the opposite direction. The boy was singing Careless Love in a voice both high and sweet. His progress was slow. The barrels slung over Cappy's back were half again as large as the ones he had carried up to the coos not long before. Coral hailed her boy of all work cheerily enough. She had reason to be cheery. Eldred Jonas had no use for fin de año abstinence, and for a man with a bad leg, he could be very inventive.
"Shimi," she called, "where go ye, seafront?"
"Aye," Shimi said. "I've got the graft them asked for. All parties come reaping fair. Aye, tons of them. Dance a lot, get hot a lot, drink graft to cool off a lot." "How pretty you look," sighed Thorin. "Cheeks all pinky pink, so they are."
"Oh, la. How kind of you to say, Shimi."
She favored him with a dazzling smile. "Go on now, you flatterer. Don't linger."
No. Off I go."
Coral stood, watching after him and smiling. "Dance a lot, get hot a lot," Shimi had said. About the dancing, Coral didn't know, but she was sure this year's reaping would be hot all right. Very hot indeed.
Three. Miguel met Shimi at Seafront's archway, gave him the look of lofty contempt he reserved for the lower orders, then pulled the cork from first one barrel and then the other. With the first, he only sniffed from the bung. At the second, he stuck his thumb in and then sucked it thoughtfully. With his wrinkled cheeks hollowed inward and his toothless old mouth working, he looked like an ancient bearded baby.
"Tasty, ain't it?" Shimi asked. "Tasty as a pasty, ain't it? Good old Miguel been here 1,000 years.
Miguel, still sucking his thumb, favored Shimi with a sour look.
"Andale! Andale, Siplon!"
Shimi led his mule around the house to the kitchen. Here the breeze off the ocean was sharp and shiversome. He waved to the women in the kitchen, but not a one waved back. Likely they didn't even see him. A pot boiled on every trink of the enormous stove, and the women working in loose, long-sleeved cotton garments like shifts and wearing their hair tied up in brightly colored clouts moved about like phantoms glimpsed in fog. Shimi took first one barrel from Cappy's back, then the other. Grunting, he carried them to the huge oak tank by the back door. He opened the tank's lid, bent over it, and then backed away from the eye-wateringly strong smell of elderly graff.
"Phew," he said, hoisting the first barrel. "You could get drunk just on the smell of that lot."
He emptied in the fresh graff, careful not to spill. When he was finished, the tank was pretty well topped up. That was good, for on reaping night, apple beer would flow out of the kitchen taps like water. He slipped the empty barrels into their carriers, looked into the kitchen once more to be sure he wasn't being observed. He wasn't. Coral's simple-minded tavern boy was the last thing on anyone's minds that morning. And then led Cappy not back the way they'd come, but along a path which led to Seafront's storage sheds. There were three of them in a row, each with its own red-handed stuffy guy sitting in front. The guys appeared to be watching Shimi, and that gave him the shivers. Then he remembered his trip to crazy old bitch lady Rhea's house. She had been scary. These were just old duds stuffed full of straw.
Susan?
He called low.
Are you here?
The door of the center shed was ajar. Now it trundled open a little.
Come in, she called, also low. Bring the mule. Hurry.
He led Cappy into a shed which smelled of straw and beans and tack. And something else. Something sharper.
Fireworks, he thought. Shooting powder, too.
Susan, who had spent the morning enduring final fittings, was dressed in a thin silk wrapper and large leather boots. Her hair was done up in curling papers of bright blue and red. Sheenie tittered.
You look quite amusing, Susan, daughter of Pat. Quite a chuckle for me, I think.
Yes, I'm a picture for an artist to paint, all right, Susan said, looking distracted. We have to hurry. I have 20 minutes before I'm missed. I'll be missed before if that randy old goat is looking for me. Let's be quick. They lifted the barrels from Cappy's back. Susan took a broken horse bit from the pocket of her wrapper and used the sharp end to pry off one of the tops. She tossed the bit to Sheenie, who pried off the other. The apple tart smell of graff filled the shed.
Here.
She tossed Sheenie a soft cloth.
Dry it out as well as you can. Doesn't have to be perfect, they're wrapped. But it's best to be safe.
They wiped the insides of the barrels, Susan stealing nervous glances at the door every few seconds.
All right, she said. Good. Now, there's two kinds. I'm sure they won't be missed. There's enough stuff back there to blow up half the world.
She hurried back into the dimness of the shed, holding the hem of her wrapper up with one hand, her boots clomping. When she came back, her arms were full of wrapped packages.
These are the bigger ones, she said.
He stored them in one of the casks. There were a dozen packages in all, and Sheenie could feel round things inside, each about the size of a child's fist. Big bangers. By the time he had finished packing and putting the top back on the barrel, she had returned with an armload of smaller packages. These he stored in the other barrel. They were the little ones from the field, the ones that not only banged but flashed colored fire. She helped him re-sling the barrels on Cappy's back, still shooting those little glances at the shed door. When the barrels were secured to Capricoso's sides, Susan sighed with relief and brushed her sweaty forehead with the backs of her hands.
Thank the gods that part's over, she said. Now ye know where ye are to take him.
Aye, Susan, daughter of Pat, to the bar K. My friend Arthur Heath will put him safe.
And if anyone asks what you're doing out that way?
Taking sweet graft to the in-world boys 'cause they've decided not to come to town for the fair. Why won't they, Susan? Don't they like fairs?
You'll know soon enough. Don't mind it now, Sheenie. Go on. Best be on your way.
Yet he lingered.
What?
She asked, trying not to be impatient.
Sheenie, what is it?
I'd like to take a fiend on your kiss from ye, so I would.
Sheenie's face had gone an alarming shade of red. Susan laughed, in spite of herself, then stood on her toes and kissed the corner of his mouth. With that, Sheenie floated out to the bar K with his load of fire. 4. Reynolds rode out to Sitco the following day, galloping with a scarf wrapped around his face so only his eyes peered out. He would be very glad to get out of this damned place that couldn't decide if it was ranch land or seacoast. The temperature wasn't all that low, but after coming in over the water, the wind cut like a razor. Nor was that all. There was a brooding quality to Hambry, and all of Magus as the days wound down toward the reap, a haunted feeling he didn't care for a bit. Roy felt it too. Reynolds could see it in his eyes. No, he'd be glad to have those 3 baby nights so much ash in the wind, and this place just a memory. He dismounted in the crumbling refinery parking lot, tied his horse to the bumper of a rusty old hulk with a mystery word Chevrolet barely readable on its tailboard, then walked toward the oil patch. The wind blew hard, chilling him even through the ranch-style sheepskin coat he wore, and twice he had to yank his hat down around his ears to keep it from blowing off. On the whole, he was glad he couldn't see himself. He probably looked like a fucking farmer. The place seemed fine, though. which was to say deserted. The wind made a lonely, soughing sound as it combed through the firs on either side of the pipe. You'd never guess that there were a dozen pairs of eyes looking out at you as you strolled. "Hi," he called. "Come on out here, pard, and let's have some palaver." For a moment, there was no response. Then Hiram Quint of the Piano Ranch and Barky Callahan of the Traveler's Rest came ducking their way out through the trees. "Holy shit," Reynolds thought, somewhere between awe and amusement. "There ain't that much beef in a butcher shop." There was a wretched old musketoon stuck into the waistband of Quint's pants. Reynolds hadn't seen one in years. He thought that if Quint was lucky, it would only misfire when he pulled the trigger. If he was unlucky, it would blow up in his face and blind him. "All quiet?" he asked. Quint replied in magus bibble-babble. Barky listened and said, "All's well, Si. He say he and his men grow impatient." Smiling cheerfully, his face giving no indication of what he was saying, Barky added, "If brains was black powder, this idiot couldn't blow his nose." "But he's a trustworthy idiot." Barky shrugged. It might have been a scent. They went through the trees. Where Roland and Susan had seen almost 30 tankers, there were now only half a dozen, and of those six, only two actually had oil in them. Men sat on the ground or snoozed with their sombreros over their faces. Most had guns that looked about as trustworthy as the one in Quint's waistband. A few of the poorer vacs had bolas. On the whole, Reynolds guessed they would be more effective. "Tell Lord Perth here that if the boys come, it's got to be an ambush, and they'll only have one chance to do the job right," Reynolds said to Barky. Barky spoke to Quint. Quint's lips parted in a grin, revealing a scarifying picket of black and yellow fangs. He spoke briefly, then put his hands out in front of them and closed them into huge, scarred fists, one above the other, as if wringing the neck of an invisible enemy. When Barky began to translate, Clay Reynolds waved it away. He had caught only one word, but it was enough. Muerto. Five. All that pre-fair week, Rhea sat in front of the glass, peering into its depths. She had taken time to sew Ermot's head back onto his body with clumsy stitches of black thread, and she sat with the decaying snake around her neck as she watched and dreamed, not noticing the stench that began to arise from the reptile as time passed. Twice Musty came nigh, mewing for food, and each time Rhea batted the troublesome thing away without so much as a glance. She herself grew more and more gaunt, her eyes now looking like the sockets of the skulls stored in the net by the door to her bedroom. She dozed occasionally as she sat with the ball in her lap and the stinking snakeskin looped about her throat, her head down, the sharp point of her chin digging at her chest, runners of drool hanging from the loose puckers of her lips, but she never really slept. There was too much to see, far too much to see. And it was hers for the seeing. These days she didn't even have to pass her hands above the glass to open its pink mists. All the barony's meanness, all its petty and not-so-petty cruelties, all its cozening and lying lay before her. Most of what she saw was small and demeaning stuff, masturbating boys peeking through knotholes at their undressed sisters, wives going through husbands' pockets looking for extra money or tobacco, Sheb the piano player licking the seat of the chair where his favorite whore had sat for a while, a maid at seafront spitting into Kimber Reimer's pillowcase after the chancellor had kicked her for being slow in getting out of his way. These were all things which confirmed her opinion of the society she had left behind. Sometimes she laughed wildly, sometimes she spoke to the people she saw in the glass ball as if they could hear her. By the third day of the week before reaping, she had ceased her trips to the privy, even though she could carry the ball with her when she went, and the sour stench of urine began to rise from her. By the fourth day, Musty had ceased coming nearer. Rhea dreamed in the ball and lost herself in her dreams, as others had done before her. Deep in the petty pleasures of far-seeing, she was unaware that the pink ball was stealing the wrinkled remains of her anima. She likely would have considered it a fair trade if she had known. She saw all the things people did in the shadows, and they were the only things she cared for. And for them, she almost certainly would have considered her life's force a fair trade. 6.
"Here," the boy said. "Let me light it, goddamn you."
Jonas would have recognized the speaker. He was the lad who had waved a severed dog's tail across the street at Jonas and called, "We're big coffin hunters just like you." The boy to whom this charming child had spoken tried to hold on to the piece of liver they had copped from the knackers behind the low market. The first boy seized his ear and twisted. The second boy howled and held the chunk of liver out, dark blood running down his grimy knuckles as he did.
"That's better," the first boy said, taking it. "You want to remember who the capataz is round here."
They were behind a bakery stall in the low market. Nearby, drawn by the smell of hot, fresh bread, was a mangy mutt with one blind eye. He stared at them with hungry hope. There was a slit in the chunk of raw meat. Poking out of it was a green Big Bang fuse. Below the fuse, the liver bulged like the stomach of a pregnant woman. The first boy took a sulfur match, stuck it between his protruding front teeth, and lit it.
"He won't never," said a third boy, in an agony of hope and anticipation. "Thin as he is," the first boy said. "Oh, yes, he will. Bet you my deck of cards against your hostail."
The third boy thought it over and shook his head. The first boy grinned.
"It's a wise child ye are," he said, and lit the Big Bang's fuse. "Hey, Cully," he called to the dog, "want to bite of something good? Here you go."
He threw the chunk of raw liver. The scrawny dog never hesitated at the hissing fuse, but lunged forward with its one good eye fixed on the first decent food it had seen in days. As it snatched the liver out of the air, the Big Bang the boys had slipped into it went off. There was a roar and a flash. The dog's head disintegrated from the jaws down. For a moment it continued to stand there, dripping, staring at them with its one good eye. And then it collapsed.
"Told yer,"
the first boy jeered.
"Told yer he'd take it. Happy reap to us, eh?" "What are you boys doing?"
a woman's voice called sharply.
"Get out of there, ye ravens!"
The boys fled, cackling, into the bright afternoon. They did sound like ravens. 7. Cuthbert and Alain sat their horses at the mouth of Eyebolt. Even with the wind blowing the sound of the thinny away from them, it got inside your head and buzzed there, rattling your teeth.
"I hate it," Cuthbert said through clenched teeth. "Gods! Let's be quick."
"Aye," Alain said. They dismounted, bulky in their ranch coats, and tied their horses to the brush which lay across the front of the canyon. Ordinarily, tethering wouldn't have been necessary, but both boys could see the horses hated the whining, grinding sound as much as they did. Cuthbert seemed to hear the thinny in his mind, speaking words of invitation in a groaning, horribly persuasive voice. "Come on, Bert, leave all this foolishness behind. The drums, the pride, the fear of death, the loneliness you laugh at because laughing's all you can think to do. And the girl, leave her too. You love her, don't you? And even if you don't, you want her. It's sad that she loves your friend instead of you, but if you come to me, all that will stop bothering you very soon. So come on, what are you waiting for?"
"What am I waiting for?" he muttered.
"Huh?" "I said, what are we waiting for? Let's get this done and get the holy hell out of here." From their saddlebags, they each took a small cotton bag. These contained gunpowder extracted from the smaller firecracker Shimi had brought them 2 days before. Alain dropped to his knees, pulled his knife, and began to crawl backward, digging a trench as far under the roll of brush as he could.
"Dig it deep," Cuthbert said. "We don't want the wind to blow it away."
Alain gave him a look which was remarkably hot. Do you want to do it, just so you can make sure it's done right?
It's the thinny, Cuthbert thought. It's working on him, too.
No, Al, he said humbly. You're doing fine for someone who's both blind and soft in the head. Go on.
Alain looked at him fiercely a moment longer, then grinned and resumed the trench under the brush.
You'll die young, Bert.
Aye, likely.
Cuthbert dropped to his own knees and began to crawl after Alain, sprinkling gunpowder into the trench and trying to ignore the buzzy, cajoling voice of the thinny. No, the gunpowder probably wouldn't blow away, not unless there was a full gale. But if it rained, even the rolls of brush wouldn't be much protection. If it rained...
Don't think of that, he told himself. That's Ka.
They finished loading gunpowder trenches under both sides of the brush barrier in only 10 minutes. But it felt longer. To the horses as well, it seemed. They were stamping impatiently at the far end of their tethers, their ears laid back and their eyes rolling. Cuthbert and Alain untied them and mounted up. Cuthbert's horse actually bucked twice, except it felt more to Cuthbert as if the poor old thing were shuddering. In the middle distance, bright sunshine twanged off bright steel. The tankers at Hanging Rock. They had been pulled in as tight to the sandstone outcrop as possible, but when the sun was high, most of the shadow disappeared, and concealment disappeared with it.
I really can't believe it, Alain said as they started back.
It would be a long ride, including a wide swing around Hanging Rock to make sure they weren't seen. They must think we're blind.
It's stupid they think we are, Cuthbert said. But I suppose it comes to the same.
Now that Eyebolt Canyon was falling behind them, he felt almost giddy with relief. Were they going in there a few days from now? Actually going in? Riding to within mere yards of where that cursed puddle started? He couldn't believe it. And he made himself stop thinking about it before he could start believing it.
More riders heading out to Hanging Rock, Alain said, pointing back toward the woods beyond the canyon. Do you see them?
They were as small as ants from this distance, but Bert saw them very well.
Changing the guard. The important thing is they don't see us. You don't think they can, do you?
Over here, not likely. Cuthbert didn't think so either.
They'll all be down come reap, won't they? Alain asked. It won't do us much good to only catch a few.
Yes, I'm pretty sure they all will.
Jonas and his pals?
Them too.
Ahead of them, the bad grass grew closer. The wind blew hard in their faces, making their eyes water, but Cuthbert didn't mind. The sound of the thinny was down to a faint drone behind him and would soon be gone completely. Right now, that was all he needed to make him happy.
Do you think we'll get away with it, Bert?
Dunno, Cuthbert said.
Then he thought of the gunpowder trenches lying beneath the dry rolls of brush and grinned.
But I'll tell you one thing, Al. They'll know we were here.